Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Kurt Dahl, who is an entertainment lawyer and plays in One Bad Son, which is just a huge, huge band around the world, but particularly in Canada, where Kurt is from. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bart. Appreciate it.
This is a fun one. So we're talking today about kind of some legal stuff. So we're talking about copyright law and drums and drum beats and can you copyright a drum beat? I mean, that's really the age-old question. And I know it's caused a lot of drama and heartache for a lot of very famous drummers like Ginger Baker and Keith Moon and John Bonham and all these guys. So I'm excited to hear about it. But before we jump in, let me say real quick, I want to give a shout out to the people who recommended this episode. So first off, my personal close, you know, Cincinnati guy I played in the band with, friend Ryan Maloney suggested this to me. And then basically the same week, Guy Licata, who is the founder of Reflex Drum Pads, which are just awesome, super popular, great drum pads. We were talking on the phone and just talking about copyright issues in general, about manufacturing. And maybe we can touch on that too. It's a little different than the drum beat thing, but so thank you to Guy and thank you to Ryan for suggesting this. But it led me down a quick Google search of copyright and drum beat, and boom, lawyerdrummer.com showed up, which that is you, my friend. So why don't we jump in here and just tell us, go back as far as you can about copyright and drum beats and the issues that have been around since the beginning of copyright.
Yeah, well, that's a daunting ask, but I'll tackle it, Bart. I like it. You know, it's interesting. I think, and I guess a starting point, Bart, I would say is, you know, just to clarify, you know, when we're talking about like, can you copyright a drum beat? We're talking about like more on the songwriting side of things. Like as far as, because there's two copyrights in every song. There's one in the recording and then one in the actual song itself, like, you know, the songwriting. And I think we'll come back to that probably a lot today, those two different copyrights. And it's a very important distinction, right? Because on the recording side, you definitely can have a copyright on your performance, you know, on John Bonham's amazing beat on When the Levee Breaks. You can damn well bet that that's copyrighted. It's owned by Atlantic Records, right?
Yeah.
And if you try to like sample, if you sample that iconic drum beat, well, then technically, you need permission or you need to pay a royalty, right? So, and this is where that gets into sampling. That's a whole other, discussion, I think,
sure.
Right? Sampling a recording, that's different. And that's where, you know, amazing records like Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys, they had so many samples on there that were not authorized. And then, like, basically, Paul's Boutique could not be recorded today. With it'd be too much legwork and too many licenses to ever become profitable. Yeah. But, so that's on the recording side. Now, what we're really talking about is drumming songwriting? You know, could I, as a drummer, go lay down a beat, the Levee Breaks drum beat on a new song that my band was recording and get away with it? And from my research, I mean, technically the answer is yes. You know, you can't really, Bonham or his estate can't really say, hey, that's his drum beat, you can't go steal that. But I think if I did go and play that exact drum beat on some other music, some other guitar riffs, whatever, I mean, people would call me a hack, you know, and a thief. But,
yeah.
You know, I think what I've found is that I don't think his estate could like sue me and say, hey, you're infringing his copyright. And I guess the real reason for that, Bart, is, you know, technically a lot of times in the eyes of the law, drumming is not songwriting. And as a drummer myself and as a lover of drums, I mean, I don't like that because I really do think that if you look at, you know, the iconic songs by Zeppelin or The Who or Queen or I mean, even like the Chili Peppers, you know, like
exactly,
the drummer or the Stones or the Beatles. I mean, the drummer is such an integral part of the sound and the nature of the songs. So I feel that drumming is songwriting. And again, with some bands, you know, for example, the Chili Peppers, they divide all the songwriting equally, and including Chad Smith. So
sure.
They acknowledge that he contributes to the writing. So Anyways, I'm going all over the place already, but
no, and it's fine. And I want to jump in and I want to throw out there real quick though, before we move on, because I've had Dylan Wissing on the podcast before who his job, it's just interesting about what you said before about, you can go and play like When the Levee Breaks. What he did an episode about, the funky drummer beat, you know, Clyde Stubblefield, who did, you know, right, that Clyde. Great James Brown. Yeah. What Dylan does though, very, you know, it's his job, is a lot of times what he'll do is recreate exactly the sound of the funky drummer beat, or, you know, any you name the original kind of beat they want to sample. His job is to recreate it with as close to the perfect snare drum, as close to the perfect preamp, into the same board if possible, to avoid those copyright issues. That's, again, it's on huge, huge songs. I know he's done it with like Alicia Keys and different people who want to use certain beats and recreate it. And there's no legal issue as far as I know.
So he recreates it without having to get a sample, essentially.
Exactly. He remakes, he makes the sample, but does it again and new and with him playing.
So you can go and recreate something, get the exact same sound. You know, of course, the same playing, like the same notes are being played, and even the same sound, and then not get a sample or not have to pay. I mean, to me, it doesn't sit right with me. And it's not just because I'm a drummer. It's also because, you know, just like from a legal theory standpoint, I mean, like, why can you do that? But if you go and rip off, you know, the riff to Satisfaction and you recreate Keith Richards, you know, guitar tone and do that riff, well, that is plagiarism. And I think, the answer comes down to, I mean, what do they consider songwriting? By they, I mean, I guess, the music industry as a whole or courts of law.
Yeah.
It's like, what is songwriting? You know, basically what courts have said is it involves melody and chord structures and lyrics, mm-hmm. not drumming. So, I think that's the heart of our discussion, I think, today is like, does that make sense? Should it be that way? I mean, when you have, you know, Keith Moon playing on I Can See for Miles, like, is that not songwriting? I mean, to me, that makes the song, right? Yeah. I don't think it's just because I'm a drum nerd. No. I think it's because I'm a music lover, right?
Yeah. Like, and I always think too that, like, you hear about these famous, I can't even pull one out off the top of my head right now. I feel like there's Chili Peppers songs where they say, oh, that's an exact song that's like, you know, a Tom Petty song. Or there's these songs where they're like sort of close and they go to, you know, fight in court over it because they say that it sounds too similar. And there's been some of them that I hear and I go, actually, I don't really hear that. Like, maybe it's the same chord structure or maybe it's this or that. So people do have huge legal battles over sort of sounding similar when it comes to melody and tonal instruments, meaning like guitar and bass and stuff and piano, but they're very sensitive about it. But us drummers have to just put up with whatever, you know, we can't stick up for ourselves.
Well, and right. It's interesting. I mean, yeah, I think it was Mary Jane's Last Dance, Tom Petty. Yep. And then they said that Danny California yep. by the Peppers. And you're right. It sort of has that, you know, kind of that same sort of riff-ish, but the riff is actually quite different. And then sort of the same delivery in terms of the cadence on the vocals, you know, but, and I won't sing the two here because I'm a drummer and no one wants to hear that, but you know, you're right. I heard that and I was like, well, a little bit, but I don't really see it. And you're right. So if that's sort of like a little bit similar and it's bringing up possible lawsuits, it's, you know, how can the drums be like I copied to the exact note and tone, and it's just, you have to just accept it. And again, I think it's sort of the definition of songwriting. And
yeah.
So I get this just as a quick aside, like I get this question all the time from bands that are my clients, you know, how should we divide songwriting, you know? And I think that's at the heart of this whole discussion is like what constitutes songwriting, you know? Mm-hmm. And I always say there's sort of like a spectrum when it comes to artists, you know, like on one side of the spectrum is like, you know, like the Bob Dylans or the Neil Youngs of the world who have a band that they sort of hire, but they write all the songs, you know, like Bob's not co-writing with anyone typically. Right. Yeah. So no songwriting goes to the band, the rhythm section, or even extra guitar players, whatever. It all stays with Bob or Neil. And then on the other side of the spectrum is bands. It's really everyone's contributing. It's sort of like jam based sort of songs. And that would be like the Chili Peppers, where they divide everything equally.
Yeah.
Everyone's bringing ideas, like lyrically, possibly, or maybe just musically.
Yeah.
And then in the middle is sort of like those bands where it's kind of not neither, but like maybe one or two people are sort of the main writer. So that'd be like the Rolling Stones, where most of the songs are Mick and Keith are the, you see them listed as writers.
Sure.
Or the Beatles. I mean, it was always Lennon McCartney, and then the occasional Harrison song that would be just strictly him.
Yeah.
And so I typically say all bands and fall somewhere on that spectrum, and you just sort of got to find out where you sit as a band.
Yeah. That's also like what we're talking about this, you know, for this instance, like this scenario right now is also kind of like an internal struggle for copyright versus external is like, someone else using a beat that sounds kind of like you. I mean, but it's like you, it raises the question of like, well, you can't copyright like the 2/4 money beat, like Billie Jean, you know, you're like, it's just such an interesting thing. It's like, well, then there wouldn't be anything. Music would stop because you can't use that beat anymore. I don't mean music would actually stop, but like you'd be kind of, you'd run out of how many variations can you do? It's like you kind of need to be able to use those. And then you can't really pick and choose and go, oh, okay, well, you can use this beat, but you can't use that beat because it's a little more creative. Like, let's say Come Together or something, you know, by the Beatles, that's more Tom-oriented. But like, I guess you just can't really pick and choose, you know?
Well, and that's a great point. I mean, that's the question, I guess. Can you, yeah, can you differentiate just your standard, you know, 4-on-the-floor beat versus When the Levee Breaks? Well, I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, we don't want every drum beat to be copyrighted because then people would stop making music because they'd be worried they'd get sued and there'd be no new ideas left out there. Except crazy, you know, jazz, you know, 7/4 sure. signature yeah. beats, whatever. Yeah. Stuff that people can't dance to, you
yeah.
know.
But
it's a good question though, because I would say, you know, you can't copyright just like G, C, D on the guitar, mm-hmm. you know, like the, but if you do that with a bunch of other chords and then sing a melody to it, you can copyright it, right? It's all of a sudden it becomes, well, whatever. There's so many songs
yeah,
that
yeah,
are that progression.
You.
Maybe there could be differentiation, but maybe we don't want it. But I guess what I'm saying is you're right. Your standard 4-on-the-floor drum beat, I think it could be differentiated from, again, When the Levee Breaks or the beat on Sunday, Bloody Sunday or whatever. But
yeah.
At the end of the day, you're right. Maybe this is the balance that copyright plays. And it's same with not just drums, with any instrument. It's like you want it there to make sure people don't, if you write a great song, you want to be paid for it because otherwise someone could just steal mm-hmm. it. But you don't want it to be too restrictive that it sort of hinders creativity. So yeah, I guess
yeah.
for me, drumming is interesting because I think there is some situations where like that, like the beat is so iconic that maybe there should be protection. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Now, why don't we maybe go backwards a little bit here and talk about some history stuff? We've obviously named some classic examples where, and you know, I think people know this now where if I could include audio examples, but the whole, that's a thing too with podcasts and copyright, where if I start dropping in Sunday, Bloody Sunday at the beginning, then I guarantee and within like, you know, 6 months or a year, Apple is going to get wise to, because a lot of podcasts do have other music, which I think is awesome, but they're going to catch on to it because YouTube, Instagram, I post a lot of drum videos on there. And the second I include more than, I would say, honestly, 1 to 2 seconds of music outside of the drum beat, because I always try to do the drum solos, it gets flagged for copyright. It's but the algorithms and all that stuff can't really catch, as far as, you know, at August 16th, 2021, they're not really able to catch me pulling off drum solo type things. So
interesting.
That's even copyright related, you know, so but man, they take it down fast. Warner Brothers or whoever, if I have like a video and then there's a split second of Brian May coming in after Roger Taylor did a drum solo, boom, it is taken down. So
interesting, but just the drum part, if it was just the drum part, it would stay up.
Yeah. I mean, it's typically a drum solo, cause there's not too many videos of a famous drummer playing just his drum beat. But yeah, like, if right, I, yeah. but I'm telling you, like, I mean, even like I remember I posted like an Iron Butterfly video and the drummer was playing, and I think I just had a crash hit, and it was like, bah. And I left it in because I was like, they're not going to catch that one note. And it got taken down like instantly. So
that's so interesting to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And it happens all the time. And, you know, I did one the other day where it was Fred Astaire dancing and singing and hitting, kicking the drums and stuff and doing a tap dance thing. And I got to pull it up here. It was only taken down in Cuba, Iran, North Korea, and Syria, where it wasn't allowed to play Fred Astaire kicking and dancing and tap dancing his drums.
They're not fans of Fred Astaire, I guess.
I mean, but really though, I'm kind of curious, why was it just those four countries that, let's be honest, sometimes there's some controversial stuff. There's political stuff going on, but I'm not sure why that actually was. But anyway, all that being said, why don't you talk to us a little bit more about how early does this go back, these problems? I feel like it kind of pops up a lot in the rock days of the 60s and 70s when drummers were kind of getting into the rock beats. But what's your earliest kind of examples of this debate?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think, you know, it really, if we're talking about copyright disputes when it comes to music, I mean, because there's not a lot of case law when it comes to the actual drum beat, you know, sort of copyright. Sure. But there's a lot of case law in terms of, as we've seen, even in the recent years, you know, the Led Zeppelin case was huge. But that's just plagiarism in general, right? Mm-hmm. That's not, and again, I should say plagiarism is a bit different than what we're talking about to some extent. But again, I guess what we're saying is, could, if I, again, I laid down the, you know, When the Levee Breaks beat on a new song that I'm recording, could I be sued for plagiarism? I mean, the answer is no, but I guess we are talking about plagiarism to some extent, right?
Yeah, but I think also we should point out that, like, in the court of public opinion, you would be probably seen as being like, what the hell is this guy doing?
A hack.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
Same tempo, same huge drum sound. You'd be kind of like, and, you know, there's a band, Greta Van Fleet, who's awesome, but they sound a lot like Zeppelin. And I think that is a thing where it's like, well, it hurts you to... and I think they're really cool, but it does hurt you a little bit to sound exactly like something in just people's opinions, which isn't legal, but it's a thing.
Yeah, well, actually, and Greta is a great example of, you know, and this sort of, it's a fascinating debate, I find. Like, you know, nothing they're doing is like actual plagiarism. Like, they're not trying to write a song that sounds like Stairway, but the overall aesthetic, the overall feel is definitely Zeppelin. Yeah. I mean, they... you know, even though they try to deny it, I mean, it's like the first thing everyone thinks of. So therefore it's pretty obvious.
Yeah. But
that's different.
If there's one band who maybe has it coming to them, it's Zeppelin though, because of the amount of songs that they have taken and kind of like,
exactly. Well, all the old blues guys. Yep. Right. And so that's what I joked. One of my website articles, where someone commented, like, they're not suing Greta Van Fleet because they've already done it so many times themselves, right? And that was sort of part of this relates, I guess, to everything we're talking about. I mean, that was part of the history of blues, was like you'd be influenced by someone else. You'd take that sort of same song, that same theme, and then just add your twist to it, yeah. Right? So early blues guys were always borrowing stuff off someone they saw in the next town or whatever, and then you sort of make it your own. That's why there's so many songs that are so-and-so blues, and then everyone does their interpretation of it, yeah. Right? That world is obviously that's a pre-copyright world where they didn't care. You know, copyright wasn't a thing. They were all just trying to, you know, pass on the tradition of blues. And then we fast forward into this world we're in now. So, I mean, I guess to answer your question, I mean, in terms of copyright issues and plagiarism cases, I mean, they started happening in like the 60s, 70s, in the heyday of, you know, what I consider like the golden era of rock and roll in many ways, yeah. You know, 60s, 70s. And also in the golden era of the sale of recorded music, you know, like, so there's a lot of money at stake. And then what I found recently is in the last 5 years, the sort of like, there has been a real ramp up in plagiarism cases that I find fascinating. I always love to write articles on these things and compare the two songs, because as a lawyer, I find it fascinating, but also as a musician, you know, like comparing the Stairway to Heaven to, was it the Taurus,
mm-hmm.
Song.
Yeah.
You know, like I find it so fascinating because as a player myself, like, you know, there is sort of the argument that everything's been done and there's no original idea under the sun sort of thing. But that being said, if you rip off Stairway to Heaven, well then it's clear you're ripping off Zeppelin, but what if they stole it from someone else, which seems to be at least the one progression, chord progression seem to be very, very much in existence prior to what Page wrote, you know?
Yeah.
So anyways, I find, like, I guess what I'm getting at is the number of plagiarism cases have increased, I think, in the last several years. And part of it, I think, is because we all of a sudden have every single song in the world at our fingertips. So we can very much easily compare the two. And I think overall, there's going to be more and more of these plagiarism suits because, again, I mean, I think, you know, maybe, I don't know, people like to look to the past for inspiration. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's going to keep happening. And with technology, you can sort of take ideas,
yeah.
You know, like the Pharrell, the Robin Thicke, you know, song Blurred Lines with the Marvin Gaye song. I mean, they admitted, like, Pharrell and Robin Thicke, and this is why they were found not guilty, but
sure.
This is why they lost the case, is because they admitted, like, in some interviews that we were going for a Marvin Gaye vibe. We ripped off a Marvin Gaye song. Like, they said that a few times. And, so I tell my clients, like, if you're going to, like, try to, like, rip off the aesthetic of a song, don't admit it in an interview.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No,
keep it to yourself.
But. Yeah. And just to, so people can do their own little research too. So you were talking about Taurus before. So the song Taurus by the band Spirit is, like, basically, I think a lot of people think that's where Led Zeppelin kind of got, you know, Jimmy Page maybe got the riffs and the ideas for Stairway to Heaven. So everyone can go and kind of check that out on their own. But, so this is, like, you know, I think it's kind of fun to do episodes like this where, yes, we're talking about drums in general, but I think really it's kind of quickly expanded into, like, music and songs and copyright. And I was watching something on, I think it was Hulu, where it was all about Who Let the Dogs Out. And I'll send you the link, actually, Kurt, because you'd love it. It was apparently that song has, like, 20 people who are, like, adamant that they were the ones who wrote that rhythm, that Who Let the Dogs Out, who, and I mean, they have recordings, they have floppy disks of them from their, like, old MPC kind of, like, you know, samplers in, like, the 90s. And it is, like, a really good documentary, but it's this, cause it's made a lot of money. And it's tons and tons of back and forth, but this can, like, this topic of copyright can really tear a band apart. I mean, it can cause friends to family members to hate each other. So it's really emotional. And that kind of leads me to, I know famously Ginger Baker is kind of on the record as being very, very angry and just
yeah.
with Sunshine of Your Love in particular about, I don't think he got any songwriting credits. I'm pretty sure, or at least everyone else got more as being the singers and the guitarist and bassist. So he is not a happy guy. Well, he was kind of mean and angry in general. I love Ginger Baker, but he's kind of a character. But that didn't help anything with famous songs like that.
Yeah, you're right. And I remember reading about that too. And again, that's the, with a band like Cream, I mean, they're the kind of band that, you know, we talked about that spectrum earlier in terms of songwriting. And for me, like, that's a band that should have been, like, a three-way split equal, because the sound is so, like, some bands, it makes sense that the sound, without one of them, it just wouldn't be the same. And I think that'd be Cream. But they just, obviously, they didn't have that discussion, or they did, and whatever, they decided that they wouldn't give Ginger any songwriting. But,
yeah,
like, some bands, and this is what I often say to bands too, like, with some bands, you don't want to divide things equally, like, because then if one person is, like, not bringing any song ideas to the table and they never show up on time to jam and whatever, I mean, like, just giving everyone equal split does not always make sense, right? Because mm-hmm. it could create, like, a freeloader, basically. So I think, but with certain bands, again, I look back over the history of rock, because that's my language is rock yep. and roll. Like The Who, that should have been, I mean, Pete Pete did, he was the genius songwriter that brought all the lyrics and often, well, and the chords. Yep. But I mean, with Aunt Whistle and Keith, I mean, to me, the greatest rhythm section of all time. And then Roger, like this killer vocalist, like there could have been an argument that they should have split things equally, but they didn't. And then, like you said, it created animosity amongst the four of them because Pete, you know, over time, all of a sudden had made several million dollars more than the rest of the guys. And so there's always that sort of element too. Maybe you want to, maybe it helps just create sort of more loyalty to the band or whatever, if you're dividing equally. But
yeah, I also think that, and I mean, this is hard to say as a drummer, but like if the guy or girl who is writing and doing a lot of that legwork, there should be a little more compensation on that end. If you're the guy actually, or girl writing the song, bringing the melody, doing all of that stuff, it is very tricky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean though? It shouldn't maybe automatically be 33, 33, 33, split. If it's three people, you know, the math can change, but, so it's gotta be a case by case scenario.
Totally. And you're right. And I should clarify, like it only makes sense in certain situations where, yeah, the songs are so, they couldn't be done without the same, those same members sort of thing. And I think it also, I mean, with my band, for example, like we all bring in song ideas on the guitar. We all bring in lyric ideas. We all write together from the ground up. So, you know, we divide everything equally songwriting wise, but you're right. I mean, if there's times where, yeah, I think if your sort of average drummer, I'll put that in quotation marks, shows up and just lays down a beat to songs that have been written outside of their involvement, then that doesn't really, it doesn't seem like songwriting to me. Right. Yeah. So it every situation is so different, you know? And again, just like I said, the Bob Dylan's band, like he brings in songs that are complete and says, here's the chords, you know, add your flair, whatever that means, to the song, but you're not a co-writer with me, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And another, so I'm going to link to your article in the show notes here, but people can find it by lawyerdrummer.com, and I'm sure it's pretty easy to find there. But there's something here that you're talking about. We'll kind of touch on, I just think throughout this, some of these famous, famous songs where you can go, oh, yeah, that's an interesting one. We Will Rock You, which arguably is maybe like, I mean, I have a 2-year-old that we do that kind of on our, you know, with stomping our foot and clapping our hands, boom, boom, bap. Arguably one of the first drum beats you'll ever learn. Obviously, let's say maybe it's the second drum beat you'll ever learn. I think we all know the first one, but it's just so like ubiquitous that it's like, it's hard to copyright that. But what you said here is, it seems that a drum beat and something else needs to be added before the piece is considered songwriting. So we do that. We will rock you. So you're adding on that boom, boom, ch. Even then you're using the big stadium and the stomping that they're doing, but it's the mixture of those things that makes it songwriting, which then ergo songwriting is copyrightable.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that sort of hints at or hits at the nature of drumming. I mean, like we're often, you know, aside from the occasional drum solo, I mean, drummers are often, you know, accompanying other instruments, right? Yeah. And so maybe that's why, like, maybe it makes sense, right? If, yeah, just going stomp, stomp, clap, like, is that songwriting or is that like, if so, then like the original caveman that did that, we have to track him down.
Find his family. But,
yeah, exactly. Who is it? Who is it? It's probably like John Bonham.
Yeah. You know, that would make
great
sense.
Great ancestor.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, then we add something. And even, you're right, even if it was like in the verse where Freddie started doing like that, na 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 na, you know, like if you had the same beat and then a different singer, you know, obviously in doing different lyrics, but with that same sort of intonation, I think that'd be like, okay, this is a ripoff and therefore that's plagiarism. But yeah, just the beat itself would not be. So it's, I find it so fascinating, especially I'm not a big hip hop guy. I'm not really a big pop guy. I'm a rock and roller, sure. But I see in, you know, pop and hip hop just rule the music biz these days. And I see that as a lawyer. In those genres, like there's so much ripping off of other songs and, you know, So I think there's going to be more and more of these sort of questions brought up is what, and then again, when it comes to the beat too, it's so intriguing because obviously in those two genres, the beat is so important, right? So like, can you take the beat from another hip hop song and then just kind of add your own hip hop, rapping over it, or, you know, is that allowed or what? And I think we're going to see more and more of those questions and more of those plagiarism cases coming up.
Yeah. The whole thing, I just keep thinking like, man, it's such a sticky situation. And then you don't want to like inhibit other people from creating. But I think there needs to be a clear, no one, I think, ever thinks it's right for someone to like sample the, like, let's say the We Will Rock You beat, and then like that exact recording, and put other music over top of it, because that's just not, that's really the, I guess, you know, like you said earlier, that's copyrightable. Like that, and I'm sure you know this obviously much better than me. What is like, so how does that work? Isn't it like a mechanical license if you want to use that? What is that kind of stuff where if you did want to use it and you wanted to pay a lot of money, you can basically get their permission and pay for it, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So it wouldn't be mechanical. Like, so a mechanical, for example, my band covered Psycho Killer by the Talking Heads. We sort of did our own take on it. You know, we just threw it. I just thought it'd be a cool song to cover, especially with like sort of an updated view on it, like more of a hard rock view instead of like a Talking Heads view on it. So, and then it became like our most listened to song on Spotify. So we sort of did it on a whim. But so for that, for example, see that's where we got a mechanical license. So you just have to go through the processes to get a mechanical license, which basically means that when we sell that cover song on iTunes, let's say we sell it for 99 cents, 9 cents goes to the writers of it, which is the Talking Heads. So David Byrne and Tina, the three main writers from Talking Heads. So that's mechanical. But as far as a sample, I mean, if you're actually sampling a song, so I had this other client release a song that had a sample of sort of obscure Paul Simon song, which is cool because I'm a huge Paul Simon fan. And so it was kind of cool. The client's like, I've got the song. I want to sample this little loop from Paul Simon. How do I do it? And so I'd reached out to Paul Simon's like publishing company, and it's like, it's called like Paul Simon Publishing in New York City. And I got a hold of the lady, and she's like, hey, she's like super friendly. And she's like, yeah. And I was like chatting with her. I was like, do you know Paul? She's like, yeah, he comes in every couple of weeks just to, he lives nearby, and he comes in and like asks what's happening with his catalog and stuff, which I thought was just pretty badass that, you know, she actually knew Paul.
Yeah.
And then we had to go through that process. And when it comes to that, I mean, you have to get approval. So in this situation, we played her, and I guess in theory, she played to him the sample. And a lot of times it just goes to the publisher, and the publisher decides if they want to. But they ended up approving it. And so then we had to negotiate a fee for that. And then maybe on that new song, if the sample is sort of an integral part of the new song, which in hip hop, I mean, sometimes these samples are they're a huge part of the new song, then you negotiate how much songwriting goes to, in this case, Paul Simon.
Yeah.
Right. So then all of a sudden you're like, you know, I think of all these new songs that like are using old tracks, you know, and old songwriting. It's such a windfall for these old artists, right? If they've, you know, if that Paul Simon song became a massive, or the new one became a massive hit, then all of a sudden he just gets his windfall of money, which without having to do anything, right?
Yeah. Pretty nice.
So that's how that would work in terms of like a sort of a sample situation.
This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at forksdrumcloset.com. This episode is brought to you by Drummer's Hands CBD Balm. Inspired by drummers' wear and tear on their hands, Drummer's Hands CBD Balm is great for targeted pain relief. Drummer's Hands combines the power of full-spectrum CBD with potent herbs including arnica and comfrey. These have been shown to relieve pain, inflammation, help heal bruising, and encourage tissue repair. The combination of these herbs with CBD makes Drummer's Hands a powerful balm. This stuff is great for hands, wrists, forearms, elbows, shoulders, traps, knees, anywhere you're aching. Plus, it smells great. The combination of peppermint, tea tree, and cypress essential oils smells like a minty pine forest. In a base of shea butter, beeswax, and safflower oil, Drummer's Hands CBD Balm is made of all-natural and organic ingredients. Small batch, handmade, lab-tested, inspired by drummers, made for everyone. Get some at drummershands.com. Use promo code DRUMHISTORY to get free shipping on your order. And a quick side note, I've been using a CBD balm on my ankle after I had surgery last October. And when I started using it, I pretty quickly started seeing results and just helping with the pain and inflammation and all that stuff. So definitely check it out and you'll love it. Good points. Okay. And then I'm also interested too in how it works with if everyone has, let's say, a whatever, like a Korg little drum pad or a Dr. Rhythm or whatever. And there's like pre-built in beats in there. And I've heard it a lot where like maybe like there's like a micro synth or something that you hear the same little oscillator kind of thing that I heard the Flaming Lips use and a bunch of people where you're using pre-built. Let's say a drum beat that's like built into like a Yamaha keyboard or something. You write to it and then you end up loving it and you just kind of put it on the song. Anyone else could use that exact same beat because it comes built into a brand name, a major brand named piece of equipment. Synth tones, bass, you know, whatever. That's just kind of an interesting thing too of like, if you don't change it or modify it, then anyone can use your same, you know, like if you use an arpeggiator or something, it's like, well, that, I guess, right? You can't copyright anything like that.
Yeah. And that's a great question. Like in theory, and I see this happen too with, so I've got clients of mine that like sell beats online and I always have to be clear when I'm saying beats. Cause like as a drummer, when I say beat, I'm talking drum beat, mm-hmm. but when I'm talking with hip hop, they call, you know, the beat, they call the whole music, sure. right? Like
the loop or
there's
whatever.
There's a drum beat. But exactly. There's a drum beat, but there's also like keys and could be guitars and bass guitar, whatever. That whole thing is called the beat. I always have to just clarify that because, you know, when we're talking to fellow drummers, a beat means something different than hip hop. So anyways, they sell beats, hip hop beats. And so I asked the same thing. I'm like, so you could, in theory, sell the same beat, the underlying music to like 1,000 different hip hop rappers. And then we'd have 1,000 different songs with the same music, but different vocals. And it's kind of analogous to what you're talking about with the, you know, like they say, like the music making apparatus, whatever it is. So with these beat companies, a lot of times you can buy the non-exclusive beat or the exclusive beat. And if you buy non-exclusive, then anyone, it's cheaper, of course. And then, but some other rapper could have the same music and then it kind of makes you look not as cool if someone else, especially if your song becomes a hit and then all of a sudden there's another song with that same music. So, mm-hmm. and then you buy the exclusive beat and then no one else can use it, and they take it down from the site in theory once you've bought it.
Yeah.
So, but that doesn't answer your question, which is, I find fascinating. Like, and I'm sure there's been examples over the history of hip hop of people that have like taken some sort of like toy essentially. Like, sure. I'm looking at one right now in front of me. I've got this Kawasaki drum making machine in front of me that my kids play with.
Yeah.
And it actually makes some cool beats. Totally. Like, I actually like it.
Yeah. That's a great point of like, or a organ that has like an old, you know, drum beat that you would play in church or whatever. Like you can hit play on that and boop, bop, makes me think of like J.J. Cale, like Call Me the Breeze. And it's just,
oh, great tune. Yeah.
It sounds
like
it's just like a kick and a snare looped coming out of like a, you know, an old Hammond organ or something.
So yeah. And that's like, I think in those situations, it's interesting. I mean, I think you could probably, well, I don't think for Kawasaki in my example would come back and say, hey, that's our beat, but it's interesting. I mean, in theory, someone else could replicate it if they wanted, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you better get to writing immediately with your toy, But, you know, it's the tone. I guess it's also like, you know, everyone in every city knows, probably in some scenario where there's a band, where there's maybe a couple bands who have like the same name, where it's just a coincidence. I've seen that like growing up with a couple bands. And then like, it's almost like whoever gets there first and gets biggest kind of gets the claim on whatever, maybe the song or the band, you know, like the band yeah. name. But so maybe it's kind of like, oh, you're copying song X. If you're using this Kawasaki toy drum, and it's like, you know, well, if they did it first, then you stake your claim.
Yeah. And that's a great point. I always say it's sort of like first to market. We say that, right? Like it's same with like certain ideas, right? Like if you've invented something, you know, like there was other companies that came out with MP3 players before, you know, Apple came out with like the iPod, but what Apple went to market first with like the best, yeah. right? So everyone, all of a sudden, all the other MP3 players were just dead, you know, yeah. dead to the world because, you know, it was just, yeah,
that's exactly
it
right.
It was just the best.
Yeah. That was a weird period with all those MP3 players that were just kind of hard to connect, and it would like, it would like never quite work right. And it would hold like 10 songs and you'd like get one for like a birthday or Christmas present. And it just like never got used. Those were the days.
Yeah. And they could hold like two albums. Yes. You had to pick your best two albums and just keep cycling through.
Yeah. Them. Yeah. All right. So I have a couple more questions. Kind of they're both very different. So I'll start with one that's, on topic of everything we've been talking about. How can a drummer, maybe let's assume that they have a little bit of musical ability on other, you know, instruments. What can a drummer do to make themselves be more proactive in the songwriting process, or just more, you know, not have to deal with these problems of, let's say you do work playing a band and there's a bunch of copyright issues, and you don't want to just be the, you know, it's the age old story of like, the drummer is driving in like a Ford Taurus or something, and the singer's in a Ferrari. Not that there's anything wrong with Ford Tauruses, but of course. But you know, just as an entertainment lawyer, what should drummers do to maybe stick up for themselves, or what can they say to, like, you know, say no, I did contribute for this arrangement. Like, I don't really play. I can play other instruments, but in bands, I've never really said like I got a riff. I mean, I kind of have, but it's more like, hey, let's go to A and then C and then back to B and then do the bridge. And I would contribute like that. What should we as drummers do to kind of get our stick our neck out a little bit and say, I want to be on the credits?
Well, and it's a great question. I mean, it really depends on the band, right? I mean, like, again, if you're the Chili Peppers, I mean, Chad Smith, you know, he's always there writing from the outset, mm-hmm. kind of like jamming with whether Flea or Fushante, whoever's in the band on guitar. Yeah. You know, but then if you're Charlie Watts, I mean, you know, Keith and Mick are working away on songs and they bring it in, and then Charlie lays down his thing. And so it wouldn't make sense for him to be like, hey, I want to be there when you're, you know, strumming on guitar. Yeah,
sure.
It's really, I don't know, band dynamics are so interesting. And I know that firsthand because I've been in one for, well, One Bad Son's been together for 17 years, and I was in a band before that for another 6 years. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, band dynamics, we could do a whole podcast on band dynamics, yeah. you know. But so I guess, I mean, really, to me, I think like some drummers such as myself, you know, can write songs, right, you know, on guitar. I think that does help, because I mean, if we look at just the strict definition of songwriting, I mean, it really, you know, if you're strumming chords on a guitar with your other band members, then you're helping shape those chords, and that could definitely be more songwriting. But let's say you're not, you can't play guitar, or you don't want to, or whatever. I mean, I think just contributing to the overall vision of where the song's going, I think is quite helpful.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's a great point. Let me ask this too. So we talk about this of like credits and songwriting credits and all this stuff. And I've done some, as an engineer, recordings with this group that I've worked with for a long time, just for work, where they call me in and I engineer it. And And before I leave, one of the that's a family of musicians, and they are already putting my information in as the engineer on like all music or like whatever ASCAP and all these things, and they're on it. So why don't you explain a little bit about what actually? It's not just like, you know, your singer Joe is like writing on a piece of paper. I wrote this song. What does that actually do? Like, where do you actually like that whole back end of like kind of the credits and all that stuff? How does that work?
Yeah, it's quite important. Like, it's more important to be registered with, you know, ASCAP or BMI, or in Canada it's called SOCAN. Like, that's way more important than being listed on the CD, you know, like, or I guess, or on the website or on Spotify. Like,
sure.
You know, like actual credit in terms of like outward recognition doesn't matter nearly as much as actually being registered, right? So, I mean, you become a member of either ASCAP or BMI in America and SOCAN in Canada, and you register the songs, right? So, as a band, if say you got a 10 song album, you go and register all those 10 songs with the appropriate writers and then the splits. And then in theory, like every time that song gets performed anywhere, like it could be on radio, it could be in a mall, it could be in a movie, whatever, like anytime that song is performed, you will get paid as a writer. So I feel like songwriting is, and I've said this often, like in the last few years, like to different, well, in interviews and on podcasts, I mean, songwriting has never been more valuable because, mm-hmm. you know, we talked again about the two copyrights is in the recording and in the songwriting. And in the golden days, like in the old days when records sold like crazy, you had millions selling records, like that generated money for the copyright, the sound recording copyright. So if you own if your record label, that's when you made all the money. These days records don't sell like they used to, of course, but music is being used and performed more than ever, mm-hmm. right? So that generates money for whoever wrote the songs. So being a songwriter, like it's just never been more valuable. And I do a lot of big negotiations for big publishing deals, and that's dealing with, you know, songwriting.
I think
it's never been a better time to be a songwriter. So as a drummer, again, if you can contribute to the songwriting and it's in a real and meaningful way, then I highly recommend it.
Yeah. And maybe this is like a call to action for drummers out there who do contribute, who maybe aren't as business minded, for them to kind of maybe like look at the back end and like, you know, maybe have a discussion with, let's say the guitarist or the singer is the one who's actually submitting for the licensing or whatever, for ASCAP or BMI or wherever you are in the world, to maybe speak up and say, hey, what's the share? Like, because maybe you've been naive up until this point and you're not really on top of the actual, like, who's getting what, because you need to get it out of the way. You need to have the conversation, be done with it, move on. So maybe this is, if you're listening to this and that's you, maybe this is a wake up call to kind of like, be like, wait, what is this percentage? Because people who are much, much, much smarter than me, who are massive, humongous, world-renowned musicians, have had battles and legal issues that are of legend. So if they have trouble with it, then I imagine if you're like me, maybe it's like, oh, it's time to look at this. If you're in a position where, you never know, a song could blow up. So get ahead of it.
Yeah, I think you're so right, Bart. And like at the heart of it is just have the discussion, right? Like, and I think these are like band discussions that I always recommend be had. And it's not only bands. I mean, it also could be just co-writing with someone else that's not in your band or whatever. Yep. I mean, have these open and honest discussions, because it's like, it happens all the time where a song does start blowing up and then you try to have these discussions and you find out, actually, no, we're not giving you any songwriting because you're just the drummer, quote unquote.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, well, that wasn't my understanding. I thought that I was contributing, you know.
Yeah.
And then it gets kind of messy, you know. And I think that, I mean, just like any relationship, it's like open communication is key. If you're in a band, especially, like, you got to have these discussions. Otherwise, it's just going to be awkward when someday you need to have the discussions instead of doing them, you know, voluntarily. So, It makes things, instead of making it sort of awkward, I think it actually makes it less awkward by having the discussion.
Yeah, I would agree completely. I mean, you're saving yourself a whole bunch of heartache down the road. So, all right. And then what I was talking about before about having a question that was completely, kind of different than this performance-based stuff is we've had some discussion on the podcast before about issues and things with copyright and trademark stuff, which I don't think that's, I think sometimes people confuse copyright and trademark. So maybe we can kind of define that a little bit as well. But with brands where, or the lug casing on a DW kit with the turret kind of round lug. And then at the same time, Heyman drums in England were using that same round badge. And there's, once you go across the ocean, you kind of have to have these, it's more of a patent thing, which I realize is a completely different, you know, field of law. But we've talked about that on the show before where there's, you know, if you're in business and you got to stay on top of these patents, and there's bootleggers making things. I know the ProLogix guys, the practice pads, we're talking about people bootlegging it in China and selling it on, I think, Amazon. So that whole thing of copyright and patent and trademark is a whole world in itself. Do you ever have any experience with stuff like that?
Yeah, we do. Like, we do a lot of trademarks. Patents, mm-hmm. like, not so much, because for patent, you have to, like, be a patent agent. Yeah. And it's more like more of a science background. But, I mean, there's people, yeah, you know, I refer, like, I've got clients that do want to get a patent. And I just refer them somewhere else. But yeah, I think it's really, you know, for trademarks, that's different. Like, if you got a brand, you got to protect it, right? So go back to the Rolling Stones, because they're just a great reference yeah. band. You know, the Stones, like, you can bet they make millions and millions a year from, you know, the tongue and lips logo. Plus they probably have several trademarks, you know, on the name itself, but also, you know, I'm sure they've got tons of different things they've got trademarks. So, same with AC/DC, like, you know, that logo is, you bet that's making millions a year. And I think at some point, if your band is succeeding, like, it definitely makes sense to trademark your band name.
Yeah. And there you hear those stories too about, like, what is it? Where, like, the Nike logo, they paid the woman who designed it like $30 or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something like that where
Jesus.
Artists, everyone needs to just, like, but, you know, I mean, to be perfectly honest, you don't think like that up front. You don't, it's sometimes it's hard to think like, oh, this band is going to be, I'll do your logo and then I'll, yeah, you pay me work for hire or whatever. I guess it's just important to really treat everything like it could be huge and have paperwork and protect yourself, you know, which is easier said than done sometimes on a daily basis.
Yeah, I find in general, I mean, what I think a lot of people, and this goes for your US listeners as well, like, reach out to me, reach out to any entertainment lawyer that you trust with questions, right? Like, you know, I think people don't, they're afraid to reach out to lawyers because they're worried about getting like a big bill or something in the mail. That doesn't happen. Like, I mean, that doesn't happen with me anyways. I mean, yeah. If you got a question, shoot me an email, go to lawyerdrummer.com, shoot me a message. And like, wherever you're at in your career, it may make sense to have like, to get a contract, to get a co-writer agreement or a band agreement or whatever, or maybe it doesn't. Maybe I say, don't worry about it right now. You're probably safe to not have anything. And at least you get that peace of mind, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you hear their band and go, dude, I wouldn't worry about it. No, I'm kidding. So what is a typical breakdown? Like, I'm talking like, you know, an average of how it works with, let's not say, I mean, I know there's bands like the Chili Peppers or where they're like brothers. They're like, they've been through everything together. They're going to do it, you know, 25 members, 2020, but what is a typical breakdown of a band that's, you know, very tight, all that stuff, but the singer writes most of the songs, the guitarist comes up with his guitar riffs, kind of a prototypical band, and the drummer does contribute a little bit. They're really a member of the band. But what is a typical breakdown of percentages that you see in those cases?
Well, I mean, again, like, it's that, I go back to that spectrum because it really... like a lot of times I do see equal split across the board. If that makes sense, then a lot of times I'll see, again, sort of the Bob Dylan model where it's like one person's doing everything. They're bringing songs fully developed into the band and then saying to the band, like, you know, play your instrument on this and let's make it a recording, and they get nothing. And then I do see like the Stones sort of setups where it's like two people are doing all the work, all the writing, and they have like a rhythm section, for example, who doesn't do the writing.
Sure.
And, but then again, that's where I think you need a band agreement, because if you're in a band, because when it comes to live revenues like that, you almost always, like, live revenues are split equally because everyone's out on the road making the same sacrifices or whatever. Right.
Gotcha.
But not always. Sometimes like one member's invested a bunch of money, or one member bought the van or whatever, or one member's like the real, it's their band and they've got sort of hired guns on tour with them. So it really depends on the situation, but which I know is a very lawyerly answer, but it really is.
Yeah.
Like, I've just seen it. I say this all the time, that there's no two bands that are the same. And I mean that, like, even if you look at the big bands that I gave as examples, like, they're all so different, right? I mean, the Who is so different than the Stones, and they're so different than the Beatles, and, you know, they're so different than Pearl Jam, you know, like, yeah. It's all over the map. So I think the important thing at the outset, again, is have these discussions and say, listen, I think we should be splitting equal songwriting, or I don't think we should, like, whatever the case is, have those discussions, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then that raises the question too of, when it comes to recordings. So I personally have played on, you know, a ton of sessions, just being a guy who works at a studio, and I'm there and they use me as a drummer. So I've done a fair amount of, like, you know, hey, come down and play on these people's, you know, songs. I signed something that's like a work for hire. That's like, you're getting $50 an hour, guarantee of 2 hours, which, you know, again, just for like a Tuesday for an hour, you get $100. That's great. But there's some that I've done where they're like commercial things where they play on TV and radio like 20 times a day. And I made $100, but it's playing constantly. I realize, though, it's like a radio thing. It's like a brand and it's like a commercial. It's got to be different, though, if you are like Ash Sohn or one of these huge, Matt Chamberlain, where you're playing on these mega records. In those cases, do they typically get like a percentage of the sales, or Josh Fries or whoever, like, you know, these session Goliaths? How does that typically work with like breakdowns that you're aware of? Do they get more of a percentage of the physical copies sold?
What I find in those situations, I doubt they would, almost without exception, I doubt they'd get a cut of like record sales. I mean, maybe if they were, you know, in some situations, but I don't think that's the norm. But what they would get, and what's a really important revenue stream, even for like anyone, like you said, you're playing on stuff that's going to be in commercials, unless they try to get you to waive these rights, you should get your neighboring rights royalties. So neighboring rights, like, that's a lot of times you get sound exchange revenues. Mm. So like ACTRA and BMI pay the songwriters, but, you know, neighboring rights cover the performers on a recording. Mm. So as a drummer, like, if you're not the songwriter, then okay, fine, we can accept that. But you should be getting performance revenues. So from Sound Exchange, et cetera. So I would say just do some research on neighboring rights and make sure, like, when you register, Like Sound Exchange has set aside, like, they've said that a producer is a performer, the, you know, the main vocalist is a performer, but also like the side musicians are performers. So like, you're entitled to those revenues. And like, I've got some clients who, and they're not even like household name clients, they made like $80,000 last year on Sound Exchange revenues.
Wow.
So and a lot of that comes from, if you get played on satellite radio, like on Sirius XM. So again, you know, if you're doing a bunch of session work as a drummer, I think you should look into neighboring rights and see if you should get a cut of that, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I'm just looking at this, and again, I'm not trying to rock the boat or anything. It's just interesting because it says, you know, without further blah, 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 exclusively without further compensation, royalties, residuals, and any other payments or consideration otherwise expressed therein. And this is just something where, like, every musician who plays on them comes in and just, I guess that's more of a straight work for hire. You came in, you played for 2 hours, you got paid, it ends there, which I have to think is fairly common. Because, I mean, again, these are like, you know, pretty cut and dry sessions. That being said, there are other sessions that happen that are that I've never actually done one, but where they're like union and they pay differently for singers and stuff. But that's not the case with these. So maybe I need to think about my life more.
And maybe in some situations they want you to waive these rights. So you're not going to get any cut of those. But yeah. I think overall, I mean, I think you should be entitled to that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I got a legal battle to fight here. Well, why don't we, I mean, this has just been awesome. The time just flew by and this is a cool episode that is just chock full of stuff. Kurt is kind enough to maybe hang out for another couple minutes here. And Kurt, what I'd love to talk about maybe is just like talk some drum and hear about your, you know, your kit and all this stuff and maybe like what you play and maybe you as a drummer for, you know, 10 minutes or whatever and your gear. And we can talk about maybe some cool cases that you've worked on or maybe some issues that have come up with real life scenarios with, you know, obviously not Zeppelin and the Who and stuff, I'm imagining in your situation, but like, you know, real deal everyday musicians who are battling it. So if you're okay, Kurt, I'd love to have you stick around after this and we'll have that little bonus talk.
That'd be great. Yeah, I'd love it.
Cool. So if you want to hear that bonus conversation or anything else, you guys can go to drumhistorypodcast.com and click the Patreon bonus link. And once you're there, you'll see kind of, you know, months and months of backed episodes, which are really, really cool. So Kurt, why don't you plug your band a little bit here, your website, where people can find you if they have like a legal question and might lead to a client and it might lead to the next We Will Rock You or something like that. Where can people find you?
Yeah.
All that stuff.
Yeah, honestly, the easiest is just go to lawyerdrummer.com or just on Instagram, just lawyerdrummer. And like, I mean, the big thing, I think part of what's got me, you know, some followers around the world is I'm always writing articles on, you know, cutting edge issues in the music biz, right? And I started doing this like a decade ago and no one cared at first. Sure. And I kept doing it for a decade. And what I realized is that like a lot of lawyers out there don't want to share this information because for whatever reason, I don't know why, maybe they don't think they should share it or whatever. I mean, to me, I had all these questions about the music biz, you know, like, should I give my producer songwriting credits or, you know, what constitutes songwriting, you know? Yeah. And I couldn't find the answer. So I thought, well, I better change that. So I wrote the articles, did the research, and now the articles get like, as you saw, when you searched, you know, my site came up, which is, to me, it blows my mind because again, it started with very humble beginnings.
Yeah.
So anyways, I mean, I think there'll be lots of articles. Just go to the articles tab and there's probably a ton of articles that are going to apply to you, whoever is listening out there.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm happy to help and shoot me a message. And people are often surprised that they message me and I get back to them. So,
well, you know, and honestly, yeah. I like looking at this article and it's almost like when you're looking at a recipe, I always go down to the comments and see someone says, whoa, that was way too much salt. Don't put that much in. So on your side, I like going down and looking at the comments and you're pretty much answering everyone. People are having really good questions and, you know, just like, what about MIDI beats? What about copying this? And you're really kind of communicating with people here. So all about that community. I mean, that's how drummers roll. So I'm glad you're keeping it going on your website.
well, thanks. I appreciate it.
And again, that's lawyerdrummer.com and it's, Kurt Dahl. And then what about your band? Where can people find your band?
Yeah. So, I mean, One Bad Son, I mean, check us out on Spotify or YouTube. And yeah, we've, you know, if you like rock and roll, like in the vein of, I don't know, Zeppelin or Soundgarden or whatever. I mean, like we're a hard rock band. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, cool. One Bad Son, S-O-N. I will be listening tonight and enjoying it with, I'll, you know, have my son, he loves to listen to heavy stuff and jump around. So we'll do that. But okay, everyone, again, check out the Patreon bonus episode. And yeah, Kurt, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Bart. Appreciate it, man.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning.